This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When Vermont Works for Women surveyed young women around the state to find out about their needs, they were surprised to find that a lack of financial literacy was a common complaint.
What young women told us is they didn't know how to fill out a tax form, they didn't know how to open a bank account, write a check, they didn't know what careers paid, they didn't know how much they'd need in order to support themselves when they got out of school.
That was Tiffany Bloomley, Executive Director of Vermont Works for Women, on this program last spring. It's not just young women, or even young people in general, though, who are at a loss when it comes to money matters. At Champlain College in Burlington, students are required to take personal finance seminars. But when the school's Center for Financial Literacy started training teachers around the state, they found even they are not always well informed. Teachers were given access to their credit reports and meetings with professional credit counselors. 10% of the teachers scheduled follow-up meetings because it turned out they needed help with their own personal finances. So how do we teach young people to be smart about money when we're not always good at those skills ourselves? Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to talk financial literacy and whether or not it's important to teach in school. The state treasurer's office certainly thinks it's important. They have partnered with the Vermont Department of Libraries and declared April 5th through the 12th Money Smart Week. And April is Financial Literacy Month. So let us know what you wish you had been taught about money when you were in school, or how you learned the concepts that you now use about balancing your finances, checking your credit. How do you know whether you're getting a good deal on a loan and whether it's good for you? Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're joined today by John Pelletier, Director of the Center for Financial Literacy at Champlain College. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jane. Thanks for covering this important topic.
When you started training teachers, and you're training teachers in high schools and elementary schools around the state to teach financial literacy, and so when you started training them and said, we're going to give you access to your credit scores, you can go online and find it, and they said, you know, up to 10% of them said, I need some more help. Did that surprise you?
Well, just to be clear, I don't know who the 10% is.
Sure.
Nor do I ever want to know.
We're not calling anybody out, right.
But this is the feedback that I received back. We partnered for 3 years with the Opportunities Credit Union. About 80% of the teachers decided to do this. So this was a hard pull. It's literally exactly what you'd get if you're getting an automobile loan or a mortgage. What the bank would look at, it's called the Tri-Merge Credit Report. It shows your three credit scores plus, you know, a printout of you know, these merged credit report information, and they went on one-on-one private sessions with certified counselors, you know, who know what they're doing. And not surprising, much like the general population, I think teachers look like the average population. Some of them had issues, and I don't think they realized it was that bad. I mean, to be clear, let's talk about subprime credit, right? So, 47% of Vermonters have subprime credit. What that means is that when you're getting a loan of any sort, it could be a credit card, it could be an automobile loan, it could be a housing loan, you're paying more than if you had better credit. And the good news is we're not as bad as the rest of the country. You know, the average in the United States is over 50%.
And we're just under 50%.
Yeah, 47%. That's correct.
So why was it important to you to show teachers their own finances in order to help them learn to teach? I mean, we're not trying to shame teachers here. We're not saying, you know, your credit, you can't teach this course unless you have perfect credit and perfect financial knowledge for your own finances.
Well, I mean, first, the program we put together was a one-week, 45-hour course taught by more than 25 instructors on a variety of topics. And part of the topics were understanding financial literacy, and the other is curriculum tools and games and ways to bring this successfully back into the classroom. So the overall goal is to give teachers the confidence, the skills, and curriculum tools they need to successfully bring this back into the classroom. And the model is very intentional and was built. We were part of a pilot program in five states. The model is very intentional. We want to teach personal finance to these teachers as it relates to them, as well as how to bring those topics into the classroom. And what we found, even though many of these teachers, over 70% of them, said they were teaching personal finance before they came to the class, Only 39% of them said they were either confident or highly confident in their ability to teach it. After 1 week, you know, a very intensive week, that goes up to 94%. And so that's what matters. The other thing we do is we actually measure the teachers with both confidence and behavioral questions before they show up, immediately after the class, and 6 months later. The important thing is their behaviors change on a personal level. You know, attitudes towards a rainy day fund, how much they're going to be putting into their 403B, you know, their retirement vehicle over and above their pension. Have I tried to figure out how much I will need for retirement, which many people don't do. So those are the sorts of things that we find. We found personal behavioral changes. And it's kind of hard to teach personal finance if you're not kind of living it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we do that.
That issue of confidence you found is pretty important, that, you know, most of the teachers who are teaching this say they're not entirely confident with all the concepts. Is that because we just haven't done a good job for generations now in figuring out personal finance, or are things changing so quickly? I mean, our parents' generations might not have even had a credit card, and now you're supposed to be teaching. We just heard Bitcoin is being used in stores. So is it a situation where we're not teaching it, or things are moving too fast?
I think it's both. I don't think it's either or, because on the one hand, we used to teach this. If you go back in time, Ted Beck, who's the president and CEO of the National Endowment for Financial Education, I was in his office one day, and he showed me a collection of books he has. And they're mathematics textbooks that were the most commonly used math textbooks in high school from about the turn of the century to maybe 1925 or 30. And if you actually flip through the pages, they're chock full of math, but personal finance math. Math taught with personal finance examples. That's how they used to teach math back when 90% of people just went to high school. They didn't go on to college. Somewhere in the 40s and the 50s and 60s, that changed. And the way it exists in Vermont today is very few schools require it as a personal finance course, say, at high school. I think there are only four in the state that I'm aware of. There may be more. Some of the tech eds are not included in that list. Many of them require it as well to be taught. So if it's taught, it's taught as an elective. Often if it's taught as an elective, it's taught as a math elective, and it's geared toward students who aren't going on to college. And so what we find is probably more than two-thirds of students graduating from high school are not even getting access to this today. And that's not that's a national issue. It's not unique at all to what's going on in Vermont. So you have that, plus you have all of the changes. Just think of the choices of mortgage options.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have so much more credit cards are given to people at such a younger age than, you know, when I was in college, I didn't have a credit card. I didn't get one. You know, until after college. And I don't think I was that unusual. But today, most of the students show up with a credit card.
Yeah, I had a passbook, I think, when I was a kid. You had to actually go into the bank and fill it out and sign it. We've been asking people, you know, what they learned, what they wish they had learned about personal finance. And we heard from Maureen, who says, I let my kids see all the money I made in a week, and then I let them look at the bills we had to pay, and they figured it out pretty quickly. That was more than 25 years ago, though. I think it's harder for young people today. Susan says, when I was 13, I was told I had to work and save money and buy my own car and insurance before I was allowed to take the driver's ed class and get a license. I was a senior in high school before I made it. And let's go to the calls. Jerry's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Jerry. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you doing?
Great.
You know, it used to be everything that it used to be, but it used to be that you could make it to the end of the week and still afford to go to the movies. I have a couple of grandchildren, and I really worry for their future. They'll come out of college owing a tremendous debt. I've heard the figures, but everybody knows them. Owing a tremendous debt just to get an education. You know, when I went to when I was younger, I went through school, and it was paid for. But now they'll come out facing this horrendous time, and this goes through the society. Wherever money can be made, it's made. You know, so my bank now charges $5 just to cash a check. It's a little more complicated than what I just said, but not much.
Yeah, Jerry, I hear what you're saying. And, you know, so interestingly, too, that we're not teaching financial literacy very well to students, and yet we're seeing students that are taking on more debt than their parents' generation did. A lot of financial issues that are coming at people when they're young that they need to figure out. So I appreciate that call. Let's go to Wayne in Huntington. Hi, Wayne. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
In 1970, about 43 years ago, I guess, in my senior year in high school, we had a year of economics, and not personal finance and not math, but economics, how economics works, how companies worked. And as a project in a class of 20 or 25 people, we had to research a number of real companies, pick two that, you know, we thought we could invest in, raise money, and everyone chipped in maybe $10 or $20. And at that time, we were too young to be able to buy anything on the stock market, but our teacher did. And we followed these two stocks for our whole senior year. And at that time, you know, there was no internet. There weren't computers. You had to look up quotes and everything in the paper. And we followed these stocks for the whole year. And at the end of the year, the teacher said, I'll give you a choice. I'll cash out the stock and you can take the money, or I'll hold it for another year and we'll see what happens. And it was a great learning example. I can still remember the name of the companies, and I've used what I've learned the whole 43 years since then, and not totally confident in all the investments that I do, but it was a really meaningful class. And if they're not teaching economics, and I'm not sure if some of the teachers that your guest mentioned, if they're having trouble with personal finance, I'm not sure they don't need to know something about economics first.
Yeah, Wayne, let's put that to John Pelletier. I hear what you're saying, and I remember hearing about classes like that, too, where you could actually do some stock investing and learn stocks. Although we did get a note from Jim who says he thinks high school seniors should receive thorough education on real-life financial issues, but he says stock-picking games or competitions shouldn't be used in schools because they encourage gambling behaviors. So different perspectives there, but John, are people learning in economic-style classes?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, and that's sort of a national trend, that to the extent you're taking an economics course, particularly if it's a full-year course at the high school level, a segment of it is allocated toward personal finance. It's very common in economic courses that they participate in something like the stock market game, which is what the email you received is referring to. And it's kind of a positive or negative. I mean, studies have been done that when students do this, their math scores go up. So there's CIFMA, who's behind one of these programs, has done a very elaborate study normalizing for economic differences. And it does show that if you play the game, you do a little bit better in math. So,
although that doesn't say whether or not you do better with personal finance later
No, it doesn't. But the problem is, you know, let's say you're playing that game and it's got a 90-day period. In fact, you know, Art Wolf, who I know you know very well, he's the president of the Vermont chapter of the Council for Economic Education. And, you know, just a shout out to Art. He does this constantly, gets the funds for it so schools can participate, high schools and some middle schools can participate in this game. And it's done online. It's done real time. It has real transaction costs. You're given some money, say $100,000, and after so many days, say 90 days, you figure out who the winner and loser is. But that does create some element of potential for having a churning behavior on buying and selling stocks. But frankly, if you do that, usually the way this works, your transaction costs eat up your gain. So, students learn some interesting lessons.
We're talking today about financial literacy and specifically about teaching it and how it's being taught in different schools and perhaps not being taught in many schools. And listeners, if you have questions or thoughts you want to share, you can post them on the Vermont Edition Facebook page, or you can call 1-800-639-2211. John Pelletier mentioned he knows of only four schools, high schools in Vermont, where financial literacy is required as a graduation requirement. But there are pockets of schools and individual teachers who are working on teaching financial literacy. And one of the ways to incorporate financial literacy into school curriculum is to find a way to make it fit within other subject matters. MC Baker is an art teacher at Williston Central School, and she teaches middle school and elementary school students about financial literacy through her art classes. MC Baker, welcome to the program. Oh, we don't have MC yet. We'll go to her in as soon as we can get her. In the meantime, let's go to Ed, who's calling in. Hi, Ed. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I have a couple of things to say. One, I think this generation lacks the checkbook. Our generation, we had a checkbook, so we balanced and we knew and we understood how much money we had in our account, whereas now they have ATM and you don't actually physically see the end of the balance, and you don't pay attention to the things that are coming in. So I think the loss of the checkbook is one of the things that hinders the people now. But also, they don't have – my father was an accountant, and his one rule was it doesn't matter how many bills you have, that there's always you to pay first. So his rule was take money and make sure that money is put inside your savings account first. And they don't teach that enough. They don't explain that there's going to be times that you're going to fall on some pretty hard stuff and you want to make sure that you have something there, not a credit card, not something that you're going to borrow a loan on that you're going to owe more money for, but something that you can dig yourself out of a hole when you need to. That's not going to charge you, 29% interest.
Yeah. Hey, Ed, you know what? I want to pick up on what you're saying here, because John Pelletier, one of the things that I was reading about this morning was how few Vermonters have savings, have that ability beyond a credit card to pay for things. And reading some of the stats, 62% of Vermonters don't have a rainy day fund, a quarter don't have a savings account, and more than a quarter don't contribute to any kind of retirement account. So we're really facing an issue where Vermonters can, and around the country, people can get themselves into pretty hot water pretty quickly.
Oh, they can. And you know, another example of that is a report came out this week where the average number of overdrafts per checking account over this past year, 2013, was over 7. And the average overdraft fee is about 30 nationally, can be as high as 50. And so think about that. I think the caller's point to not keeping track of your balances. I guess the only thing I would say is to the extent we live in a technology world and you have access to the internet or you have a smartphone, your banks have applications. You can know exactly how much you have before you use that debit card. You can have a pretty good feel if you have access to some level of computer technology. But it's a real problem. Using that example of the overdraft, I mean, if you overdraft to pay a $100 bill and you get charged with $30, that's pretty usurious, right? That's a 30% mm-hmm. interest rate because maybe you weren't managing your cash well enough. And part of the problem goes to, the other data point is, the Vermonters who, by that same survey, the FINRA Investor Education Foundation study referring to, Vermonters who are spending equal to or more than their income is 55%. So you get a lot of people living paycheck to paycheck. By the way, I want to be clear, it's okay to spend more than you make. That's called retirement if you do it right. And so you would expect some element of your population to be doing that. And by the way, this rolls, if you're not saving when you're young, it rolls into retirement. So, we have a situation in this state where we're probably a quarter or more of Vermonters are relying almost exclusively on Social Security. And the average individual benefit is about $14,500 per year. So if you're a couple, that's $30,000, max. And 50% – rather, 60% or more of Vermonters rely on Social Security for more than half of their income. So if you're looking to save, the one thing I say to young people is start young. They've got the time value of money. If you can double your money, I'll give you one quick example. If you're 22 years old and you can double your money every decade, that's about a little over a 7% return. If you could put it in something that would give you over a very long period of time a return of about 7%, at age 72, you now have $320,000. So $10,000 will turn magically into $320,000. But if you start saving when you're 52, you know, that 10,000 becomes 20 at 62 and becomes 40,000 at age 72. If you start too late, it's so hard to catch up.
Yeah, another reason why it's important to know these kinds of things when you're young, when you can make that difference early on. We're talking about teaching financial literacy today, and we're going to hear from several Vermont teachers in just a moment. And listeners, you can share what you wish you had known in high school, if you think it's reasonable for teachers to be teaching this or something that parents should be in charge of. Why don't you post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page? You can also call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. John Pelletier is the director of the Center for Financial Literacy at Champlain College. He's helping explain why financial literacy is lacking in America's young people and answering some questions about money as well. And listeners, if you've got some of those questions, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post to the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're also talking today with some teachers who are looking at financial literacy and incorporating it into curriculum. And let's talk now with MC Baker. She is on the line with us. She's that art teacher in Williston that I mentioned a little while ago, who's teaching financial literacy concepts to third through eighth graders. MC Baker, what a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for calling.
Thank you so much for having me.
So how do you incorporate financial literacy and art that don't necessarily seem like they'd go together?
Well, art is an amazing tool that integrates really into any subject. But the State Treasurer's Office and the Vermont Bankers Association has a poster contest every year. And there's different themes. And what I do is I use that poster as a vehicle to introduce financial literacy to my children.
So through the poster, what do they do? Do they you know, explain for people who aren't familiar with this poster.
Okay, so this year's theme was Think Before You Spend, and every year it's different. So they judge on the artwork and expressing the theme and informational text. So I will definitely cover composition and layout, and then also there's a pretty good discussion about financial literacy. And I use the art to basically reinforce student learning of money. With my elementary school kids, I use the phrase pay yourself first, and we talk about savings and spending. We use a lot of stories. We do math problems that if I decided to get a coffee every day, how much would that be over a year? And we talk about spending choices. And I think that Think Before You Spend is a great theme.
How young do you start them?
So third grade is about 9 years old. And my middle schoolers are 12 and older. Now, the middle schoolers, we still do the same kind of concepts and talking and storytelling and math. And this year it was kind of exciting because I had my principal, Walter Nardelli, come in, and he was explaining Roth IRAs versus regular IRAs, and we get into dollar-cost averaging and compound interest. And again, we have that art theme going through, and so there's nothing like a little competition to kind of spur the kids on, too.
Well, what a pleasure to talk with you, and interesting to hear about how you're using, you know, a poster concept or poster contest to get these concepts across. MC Baker, art teacher at Williston Central School, thank you so much.
Oh, no problem.
Let's turn to another person who's looking at financial literacy in the classroom. Vermont Treasurer's Office provides a curriculum called Reading is an Investment to 130 elementary school librarians across the state to help in teaching financial literacy. And one of the librarians who uses that curriculum is Robin Bryce. She's a library media specialist at Montgomery Elementary School and Waterville Elementary School. Robin, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for having me today.
Well, we appreciate your time. And, you know, I'm interested to hear how you teach these concepts to elementary and middle school students. We heard from MC Baker about using art. What do you do?
Well, I appreciate the efforts by the Office of the State Treasurer's Reading is an Investment program because they supply the text that's connected to the theme through reading as an investment. The theme this year is about choices having cost and benefits, and we're also given quite a wide variety of additional recommended titles that meet the students at different grade levels. So in the library class, I read these books to my students at story time, and we explore or discuss the vocabulary and the concepts as a whole class. I think the library class is the best place to explore many learning concepts through story because we don't have that rigid expectation that, oh, we only have this much time for math or this much time for literacy. We can explore these concepts deeper.
Well, tell us about one of the books that you read to give us a little bit of a deeper example. Lemonade in Winter sounds like a good one.
It is. One of the three financial literacy books that we read is Lemonade in Winter, and this is also a book that is on a Vermont Red Clover Book Award list. And this is written by Emily Jenkins. And the students in this story, they learn to count quarters, while the main characters, Pauline and her brother John, they make lemonade and limeade, and they sell it outside in the snow. Doesn't that sound like fun in Vermont?
Well, sounds like something you'd have to be doing if you wanted to sell lemonade most of the time.
That's right. Well, in this story, it really talks about them getting their supplies and how many quarters it costs. It costs 24 quarters for their supplies. But then when they sell their lemonade, they only earn 16 quarters. So constantly the kids are doing that math. Well, how much money is 16 quarters? 4 quarters make a dollar, and 16 quarters equals $4. So my older students quickly realized that when Pauline and John reduced the price of a cup to 25 cents a cup, they didn't cover their expenses. And so students then had to brainstorm how these characters could have turned a profit, maybe by sampling a little less lemonade or waiting a little bit longer to reduce the price of a cup. And they also realized that Pauline and John did not begin this endeavor with a financial goal in mind. So we had a very rich discussion about setting goals. With my younger students, this was a fantastic opportunity to identify the value of the different coins and bills, because at the end notes of this book, they're very rich, and Pauline describes all the different values of the coins to her brother. So it's a fun book to be able to share and explore with students at a young age, where kindergarten and first graders all the way up through fourth or fifth graders.
Robin, we got a note from a listener who has a question about books, and I thought both you and John might be good at answering this. Kristen says, I'm a teacher at Bellows Falls Union High School. Every year we do an all-school read over the summer and organize some events that pertain to the book. This year we're considering Financial Literacy for Teens by Chad Foster. Are there other books on this topic that we should consider? We're looking for something engaging and relevant to 14 to 18-year-olds. What do you think, Robin?
I can certainly offer a book that's called When Money Grew on Trees, and I can pull up the author while we speak to refer to that appropriately. But it's about a group of kids who have this apple tree, and they have to, they're given the opportunity, if they can revitalize this whole orchard, then they can have the profits from it. And it's just a few children that are trying to figure out how to do it, and I think it takes place back in the 1960s. But it's a fantastic read aloud on how their hard effort pays off. And it wasn't always easy for them to do, but a story of family and a story of struggle and definitely obstacles, but look at what the power of what kids can do. And I think that also mirrors one of the financial literacy books that is in this program about the boy who harnessed the wind. It also shows about that one child who, instead of playing with his friends, look at what he can do to make a difference and bring water and electricity to his community just at 14 years old.
Robin Bryce is a library media specialist at Montgomery Elementary School and Waterville Elementary School. Thanks for joining us today. Really appreciate it, Robin.
Thank you.
We're also talking today with John Pelletier, who's the director of the Center for Financial Literacy at Champlain College. And it sounded like Robin's book might be good for younger readers, but what about for that high school age group, John? Do you have any suggestions?
Yeah, there's a couple. I look for those all the time when the teachers come in, and I look for something that has an authentic voice that would appeal to the students. I'll give you two or three that come to mind. One is a book, I wish I could remember the author's name, called Walden on Wheels. It's about a young man who, after graduating with a lot of debt, True story. In college, decided when he went to grad school he wasn't going to do that again. And he went to Duke as an English major and basically lived in a van in a parking lot. And that thus Walden on Wheels. And it's an interesting read. That's a little bit different than a how-to personal finance mm-hmm. book. There's a couple by an author, Zach Bissonnette, who was running a blog when he was at the University of Massachusetts. And one of his books is entitled Debt Free You, that is trying to get people to think about how can I get out of college with as little or no debt as possible. The other, I think the title is something like, you know, how to be richer, smarter, and better looking than your parents.
That would be appealing to high schoolers.
So you've got to look at that. There was another one I found that unfortunately is out of print. I couldn't find it the other year, called Zombie Economics. And so it was talking about economics, but all in terms of that wonderful zombie culture that's out there.
Yeah, that sounds pretty actually pertinent to today. Maybe they'll bring it back. Well, let's go to another person who's teaching high school students. And George Cook teaches at U32 High School in East Montpelier. I think that's one of the schools that requires financial literacy before graduation. George, thanks for calling in.
Thanks very much for having us. I appreciate it.
So it sounds like high school students might like zombie economics. What do you teach your high school students?
Well, the students right now are currently actually reading a book that John recommended to us called The Automatic Millionaire. I'm also in here right now with a junior from U32, Sylvia Gilbert, who's in the class, and I figure she could give a student's perspective as well.
Yeah, go right ahead.
Hi. I'm in the financial literacy class right now, and we are working with the Microsoft Money program and figuring out personal finances and how to budget your money.
Well, that sounds great. So what do you think about it? Do you like it?
Yeah, it's definitely really helpful and given me a new perspective about money and how to save and what to spend on and unnecessary expenses.
Thanks for giving us that perspective. I appreciate it. And George, if you're still there, I'd love to know for you why you think this is important at your school for students to graduate with this knowledge rather than have it as an elective where it is in a lot of schools.
Sure, that's a great question. As I'm sure John can kind of back me up here, groups like the Jumpstart Coalition have shown for years with very, very thorough studies that across the country, American teenagers are failing in this area. If this were a subject like English, mathematics, social studies, science, there'd be school improvement plans put in, there'd be courses of action moving forward to kind of get the students back on track. And here we are knowing that students across the country are really struggling with this material, yet it's not something that's required by high schools. So about 2 years ago, we brought it to the attention of the U32 administration and the school board of directors. And I have to say, it soared through every angle possible in order for us to get this through. And we've had nothing but just unbelievable feedback from the students, the parents, and the members of the U32 community.
And John, that's something you'd like to see at more schools?
Oh, absolutely. Somehow integrated. I mean, I recognize we're a local control state, and it's going to be very hard probably to get another mandate on anybody's list. Some schools like U32, Fairhaven Union did the same thing this summer for the graduating class of 2018. If they want to make it a mandate, that's great. But if not, we got to figure out how are we going to incorporate it into the existing curriculum. And one good spot could be mathematics. There are two states, Kansas and Colorado, where that's the approach they've taken. They mandate personal finance be embedded in mathematics and actually assess it as part of the mathematics assessment. And so a lot of people are looking at the Common Core, where you could give readings on language arts, the language arts Common Core in the mathematics Common Core. But, you know, we're at a point right now in this state where our educational frameworks have not been rewritten since the fall of 2000. They have to be because of the Common Core. And so that's a process that the Agency of Education and others in the state are beginning. And if you would actually look at the educational framework right now, there's a section on personal finance. Everything you need to know about personal finance, if a ruler is your benchmark, it's about an inch, K through 12. Everything you need to know is in about an inch. Whereas, other topics, More environmental topics, things of that nature, are half a page. And I'm not saying that those aren't important topics, but I think that our financial system is just as important in how personal finance works.
George Cook, we just have a couple of seconds left, but I want to ask you, because we started this off by talking about how teachers themselves don't always have a great grasp on this. Have you learned to balance your finances better through teaching your students?
Yeah, and I agree again with what a caller had said earlier. I was kind of fortunate enough to grow up with this. My mother was a professor of accounting and finance at a small college in Connecticut, so I kind of grew up with this. But the second that I knew that John was launching this program here with the Center of Financial Literacy at Champlain College, we immediately jumped on board. And I have to say, it's unbelievably important for all the teachers to have the training in this content area as well. And with this professional learning community that we have with Champlain, we're fortunate enough to really be getting that experience.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much, George Cook, for sharing your experiences and teaching at U32 in East Montpelier. Appreciate your time.
Take care.
And John Pelletier is the director for the Center for Financial Literacy at Champlain College. Great shout out there from George Cook. We also have a link that we'll put up to a report that the center did on how each state is graded in financial literacy. We'll put that up at vpr.net. John Pelletier, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, the latest installment in our series, Dorothy's List. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. This school year, we've been sharing stories about the books nominated for the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Book Award. The winning book is selected by Vermont 4th through 8th graders who read the books nominated to the annual DCF list. Today, VPR's Amy Noyes takes us to Stowe Middle School, where Vermont author Rebecca Roop is discussing her novel After Eli with a group of 7th graders.
After Eli tells the story of a transformative summer for Danny Anderson when he makes a new set of friends who help him heal from the loss of his older brother Eli. But as Stowe Middle School student Ethan Barrett observes, for a book about grief, After Eli can be pretty funny.
This book perfectly tied the elements, and like it would be extremely sad at one moment, then you'd read about the twins trying to get their hands on nitroglycerin. It'd just be hilarious. And you can't be sad when you just think about 9-year-olds trying to create weapons of mass destruction.
Danny's brother Eli was killed fighting in Iraq, and Danny is not really sure if Eli died heroically or needlessly. To help sort things out, he's created a notebook to chronicle noteworthy deaths throughout history. He calls it his Book of the Dead. Ethan tells author Rebecca Roop that he likes how she starts each chapter in After Eli with a death Danny has collected.
Why is Eli's father so strict? Was your father strict, and are you trying to tie elements of your life into the book?
I try to tie elements of my life into the book, but not in terms of the father relationship. But Danny's father, I'm not sure I'd exactly call him strict. He's more like disconnected. He's busy, he's occupied with other things. He clearly was more connected to Eli and more invested in Eli than he was in Danny, who's much younger.
Because Danny's father was so distant, Eli took it upon himself to teach Danny what he needed to know. Here's author Rebecca Roop reading a passage where Danny recalls his education days with Eli.
Here's some of the stuff Eli taught me on our education days. How to crack my toes. How to whistle. Which finger to give when you're giving somebody the finger. All about bras. How to smoke a cigarette, even though he told me not to get in the habit because it would rot my lungs. How to drive a car, even though he could only go 15 miles per hour up and down the dirt road in back of the barn. How to unlock a car door with a coat hanger after you've gotten out of the car and slammed the door and left it running with the keys inside it by mistake. How to shoot a BB gun, what not to shoot it at, and why don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes was a stupid idea. The 7 words that nobody is ever supposed to say, and when you can say them anyway. How to light a barbecue grill in under 30 seconds using a technique I had to swear never to reveal to Mom or in print. How to throw a football. What to do in a fight. He also told me where babies come from and how to make sure they don't, which pretty much freaked me out at the time, but Eli said, give it a few years, and I'd realize that there was a lot of potential there. I never thought about how I'd get along without Eli being there. In all those education days, that's one bit I never learned.
Seventh grader Lindsay Singer noticed a stark contrast between the two brothers, Danny and Eli. She wondered which brother the author related to more closely.
Who were you more like growing up? Danny, who's kind of, you know, more like, you know, he's got friends and he doesn't really care about school, or Eli, who was dedicated to school, had a plan, had a dream, you know, knew what he wanted to do?
Definitely Eli. I was also the oldest, so I got to boss the younger sibling around. He didn't always boss very well, I gotta say.
Was that cooperative?
Yeah. Eli, I was a really driven student and really pretty set on heading into science and going to grad school and the whole shebang.
Seventh grader Noah Levine observed the book has so much emotion in it, and he wondered how much of it was informed by Roop's own life.
When writing the book, there were a lot of emotional parts. Did you have to incorporate some experiences in your life into the book?
Always. Always. You always dredge into your feelings, your childhood, your experiences, things that have upset you terribly in the past. You know, you use all that. And in a way, you write it out. It helps you go through it just watching Danny go through it. So, yeah.
Stowe seventh grader Annie Schaefer likened Rebecca Roop's writing to that of her favorite author.
John Green's books are very similar to yours. Did he somehow, inspire you to write something similar to his books?
That is such a compliment, because I love John Green's books. I suppose that so many books go into my writing. I think most writers are bookworms. Mm-hmm. And so you get bits and pieces, you get scraps of ideas from all kinds of places. And I can't say specifically that there was a piece of John Green's books that connected me to writing after Eli. But in bulk, you know, your whole reading always goes into what you're writing.
Seventh grader Emma Hinkson noticed the book has so many messy, advanced themes. And yet the ending, in her opinion, ties everything together. Emma asked Rebecca Roop how she decided on the ending of the book.
You ended after Eli neatly, almost like a happy ending. All questions were answered. What is your reasoning behind the neat ending?
Well, you know, I didn't see it as a totally neat ending. You know, I didn't think that Danny had really yet come to grips with losing Eli. He had become resigned. He'd come to the realization that his life was going to go on. He'd discovered new friends. He'd discovered a new passion. And things were going to move ahead. You know, like with the example of the Civil War death, where the dead girl's mother went ahead the next day and baked bread. And Danny first thought that was so heartless. And then he said, well, no. When he thought about it, he thought it was the right thing to do, because life goes on and people have to eat. And I think that's where he reached that conclusion.
After Eli is an emotional book. Parts of it made the students laugh out loud, and some said it also made them cry. Shane McGinnis described it this way.
You know, on a dark day, it's kind of like dark and gloomy, it's raining, and it's like been bad all day, but then suddenly the clouds start moving out and then there's this ray of sunshine. It's kind of like that. This book altogether, it kind of has a bit of a dark feel to it, but there's still like a light in there, kind of something to look forward to, something to relate to, something to kind of like lighten up your spirits as well, like it did with the characters.
You know, I read somewhere that all happiness is always shot through with yeah. unhappiness, and all unhappiness
kind of like
is shot through with happiness.
Kind of like
so, yeah.
Without unhappiness, we wouldn't know what happiness is. Without war, we wouldn't know what peace is. Kind of like that.
Yeah, I thought that was very powerful. If there wasn't sadness, we wouldn't know what happiness was, and we couldn't be able to enjoy anything.
This discussion would have rung true with Dorothy Canfield Fisher, who wrote, "It is not good for all our wishes to be filled. Through sickness, we recognize the value of health. Through evil, the value of good. Through hunger, the value of food. through exertion, the value of rest. For VPR News, I'm Amy Noyes.
And Amy was speaking with students from Stowe Middle School. They were speaking with Swanton author Rebecca Roop about her novel After Eli, which is nominated for the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Book Award. April is a busy month when it comes to the DCF Award. Vermont students in 4th through 8th grades who've read books on the list are voting for their favorite title. The award winner will be announced later this month. And we'll wrap up this year's Dorothy's List series by taking a close look at the winning book after it's been announced. We'll also preview some of the new books on the DCF list. Dorothy's List is sponsored by the VPR Journalism Fund. Tomorrow on this program, medical marijuana dispensaries in Vermont. Dispensaries have been open for about a year, and lawmakers are debating a bill that would authorize two more and allow for home delivery of medical marijuana. We'll discuss the details tomorrow on the program, so send your thoughts to Vermont Edition at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.